Dade County, nothing but trouble. The second name is unknown to me. There are 2,000 prisoners at Garvin, and thankfully I don't know them all.
Any chance it was a gang matter?
I doubt it. The gangs are always at war, but Quincy stayed away from them, from what I'm told.
Frankie takes a sip from his bottle and pulls a white envelope from a coat pocket. He places it on the table and says,
"Here's 5,000.
I said 6,
Mosby says without reaching for the money. From another pocket, Frankie pulls out a roll of bills and keeps it below the table. He counts quickly and hands over 10 $100 bills.
That's 6.
Mosby gives him the scrap of paper with one hand while taking the cash and the envelope with the other. Frankie unfolds the paper and looks at the three names. Mosby says,
"There's something else. Quincy didn't go down easy. He landed some punches while he was able. The first name there survived with a crushed nose. He was treated at the infirmary this afternoon. Said he got in a fight. Happens all the time and few questions are asked. His face will be messed up for a few days, so I'd move fast. A little confirmation."
"Thanks. Anything else?"
"Yeah. I won't be going back to the hospital. They're alternating guards now, and we're always short-handed. Tell Mr. Post I appreciate the business."
"Will do. And we appreciate it, too."
I give Maisie the first name, Vicky the second, while I pursue all three. 15 minutes after Frankie said goodbye to Mosby, our three computers are raging through the internet. Robert Earl Lane was convicted of first-degree murder for the killing of his girlfriend 17 years ago in Dade County. Prior to that, he served 3 years for assaulting a police officer. John Drummick killed his grandmother for $60 in cash, money he needed to buy crack. He pled guilty in Sarasota in 1998 and avoided a capital trial. Both have been at Garvin Correctional Institute for about 10 years, and since their prison files are confidential, we can't find much. Maisie can usually hack into almost anything, but we decide to avoid breaking the law. Likewise, prison gangs such as the Aryan Deacons are not known to keep much in the way of records, so there is no way to verify their membership. The guard is Adam Stone. White male, 34 years old, resident of a little hick town half an hour from the prison. At 2:15 a.m., Frankie finds Stone's home and calls in the license plate numbers of his car and pickup truck. At 3 a.m., the team at Guardian has a conference call and all info is exchanged. We put together a plan to dig deep into the backgrounds of Lane and Drummick and learn as much as possible about the Aryan Deacons in Florida. Our theory is that the hit on Quincy was ordered and paid for by someone on the outside. Lane and Drummick had nothing to do with the Russo murder. They're just a couple of hard-timers doing the job for a few bucks. The fact that their victim was black made the attack more enjoyable. At 5 a.m., I return to the hospital and find the visitor's lounge empty. I'm stopped at the ICU desk by a nurse, so at least someone is awake. I ask about Marvis Miller, and she nods toward Quincy's room. Marvis is asleep on a rollaway cot, protecting his brother. There are no other guards or cops around. The nurse explains that last night around midnight, Marvis became upset at the lack of vigilance and demanded the cot. Her boss agreed, and they rolled one into Quincy's room. I thank her and ask, "How's the patient?" She shrugs and says,
"Hanging on."
An hour later, Marvis stumbles forth, rubbing his eyes and happy to see me. We find some stale coffee and sit in folding chairs in the hallway, watching the parade of nurses and doctors doing their early rounds. One group motions for us to join them at Quincy's door, and we are informed that his vitals continue to show slight improvement. They plan to keep him in a coma for several more days. Marvis is worried about losing his job and needs to leave. We embrace at the elevator, and I promise to call if there is a change. He promises to return as soon as possible, but he's almost 5 hours away. Two heavily equipped Orlando policemen appear, and I chat them up. They plan to hang around for an hour or so until a prison guard arrives. At 7:30, I get an email from the prison. The warden has a few spare minutes to grant me an audience. I arrive at Garvin 45 minutes before my 10 o'clock appointment. I try to explain to the staff at check-in that I have a meeting with the warden, but I'm treated like every other lawyer there to see a client. Nothing is easy in a prison. Rules are entrenched or they are amended on the fly, whatever it takes to waste more time. I'm finally fetched by a guard in a golf cart, and we go for a spin toward the administration building. The warden is a large black guy with a real swagger. 20 years ago, he played football at Florida State and was drafted into the NFL, where he lasted 10 games before blowing out a knee. His office is adorned with colored photos of him in uniforms and autographed footballs and table lamps made of helmets. Looks like he played for the Packers. He sits behind a massive desk that's covered with files and paperwork, the domain of an important man. To his left stands the prison lawyer, a pale white bureaucrat who holds a notepad and stares at me as if he just might drag me into court for some reason, or no reason at all. "I've got about 15 minutes, the warden begins pleasantly. His name is Odell Herman. On the walls, there are at least 3 framed jerseys of different colors with the name Herman across the back. You'd think the guy made the Hall of Fame. "Thanks for your time," I reply like a real smartass. "I'd like to know what happened to my client, Quincy Miller." "We're investigating and can't talk about it yet. Right, Mr. Birch?" Mr. Birch offers a lawyerly nod to confirm this. "Do you know who attacked him?" I ask. "We have suspects. But again, I can't talk about it right now." "Okay, I'll play along. Without divulging names, do you know who did it?" Herman looks at Birch, who shakes his head. "No, sir. We don't have that information yet." At this point, the meeting is over. They are covering up and will give me nothing. "Okay. Do you know if a guard was involved in the attack in any way?" "Of course not," Herman says with irritation. "How dare I suggest something so outrageous?" "So, as of today, 3 days after the attack, you don't know who did it, and you claim that no one working for the prison was involved. Is that correct?" "That's what I said." I abruptly stand and head for the door. "There were 2 thugs who attacked my client. The first is Robert Earl Lane. Check him out. Right now his eyes are swollen shut, bluish in color, because his nose was broken by Quincy. Lane was treated at your infirmary a few hours after the assault. We'll subpoena the records, so don't lose them." Herman's mouth opens, but no words escape. Lawyer Birch frowns and looks thoroughly confused. I open the door, pause, and conclude with, "There's more to the story. It will all come out when I bust your ass in federal court." I slam it behind me. Chapter 33. The Orlando office of the FBI is located in a 4-level modern building in the suburb of Maitland. Susan Ashley and I arrive early for a 3 o'clock meeting with the powers that be. She has spent the past 2 days making contacts and jockeying for the appointment. She has also sent along a short summary of our file on Quincy Miller. We have no idea which special agent we'll meet, but we are optimistic that we'll find someone willing to listen. Her name is Agnes Knowlton, early 40s and with enough clout to have a nice corner office. Along the way, we pass dozens of agents in cramped cubbyholes, so it's readily apparent that Agent Knowlton has some seniority. In her office, we are joined by Special Agent Lajewski, who looks like he should still be in college. After coffee is served and the pleasantries are finished, I am invited to do the talking. I quickly summarize Guardian's work on behalf of Quincy Miller and give the opinion that he was framed by a drug gang with a lot of help from the ex-sheriff of Ruiz County. Now that we're pushing for post-conviction relief, those responsible for the murder of Keith Russo are feeling the heat. I give the names of Nash Cooley, the drug lawyer in Miami, and Mickey Mercado, one of his henchmen. I speculate that these two, along with other unknowns, are responsible for the rather brilliant idea of ending our investigation by eliminating our client.
"Would that work?" Knowlton asked. "If your client dies, what happens to the case?"
"Yes, it would work," I reply. "Our mission is to get innocent people out of prison. We don't have the time or resources to litigate from the grave." She nods in agreement, and I continue. I describe Quincy and make much of the fact that he was not involved with gang activity. Thus, there should have been no reason for the Aryans to attack him.
"So, we're talking about a contract killing?" she asks.
"Yes, murder for hire, a federal offense." It's obvious, at least to me, that Knowlton is intrigued by the case. Lajewski keeps a poker face but misses nothing. He opens a laptop and starts pecking. I continue, "And we have the names of the two assailants, both convicted murderers. You've heard of the Aryan Deacons?" Knowlton smiles and likes it even more. A drug gang? A Mexican cartel at that, a crooked sheriff, the murder of a lawyer at his desk, a wrongful conviction, and now an attempted contract killing to stop an effort at exoneration. Not your everyday case.
"Sure," she says. "But we're too busy putting people in prison to worry about what happens once they get there. Do you plan to give me the names?"
"What will you do with them?" She ponders this as she takes a sip of coffee and glances at Lajewski. He stops pecking and says,
"The Aryan Deacons spun off from the Aryan Brotherhood, the largest white prison gang in the U.S. The Deek's membership is estimated at 10,000, though record-keeping is spotty. Typical gang activity, drugs, food, sex, cell phones. Their alumni, the few who get out, remain members and carry on criminal activity. Pretty nasty bunch of boys."
Knowlton says to me,
"Again, we have our hands full on this side of the wall."
I say, "There's also a prison guard who's probably involved. White guy who looked the other way. He could be the weak link because he has more to lose." She says,
"I like the way you think, Post."
"We're in the same business, sort of. You solve crimes to lock people up. I solve crimes to get people out." It was a typical work day for Adam Stone. He punched in at 7:59 a.m. and spent 15 minutes at his locker drinking coffee and eating a donut with two other guards. He was in no hurry to report to Unit E for another stressful day of supervising criminals who would kill him if given half a chance. A few of the men he liked, and he enjoyed their banter. Others he despised or even hated, especially the blacks. Stone had been raised in a rough rural area where few blacks lived or felt welcome. His father was a bitter racist who despised all minorities and blamed them for his lack of upward mobility in life. His mother claimed to have been sexually assaulted by a black athlete in high school, though no charges were ever filed. As a child, Adam was taught to avoid blacks when possible and to speak to them only in unpleasant terms. As a prison guard, though, he had no choice. 70% of the population at Garvin was black or brown, as were most of the guards. For the 7 years Adam had worked there, his racism had only deepened. He saw them at their worst. Caged men who had always been discriminated against and abused were in charge of an environment they controlled. Their retribution was often sickening. For protection, the whites needed their own gangs. He secretly admired the Aryans.
Outnumbered and constantly threatened, they survived by swearing blood oaths to one another. Their brand of violence was often breathtaking. 3 years earlier, they had attacked two black guards with razor-sharp shanks, then hid the bodies and watched them bleed to death. During the day, Adam made his rounds, escorted prisoners to the infirmary and back, spent an obligatory hour watching surveillance cameras, stretched his 30-minute lunch break into an hour, and punched out at 4:30. 8 hours of work without breaking a sweat at $12 each. He has no way of knowing that agents working for the federal government spent the day digging through his life. Two of them trail him as he leaves the prison. He is driving his pride and joy, a late-model Ram monster truck with oversized tires, black rims, not a speck of dirt anywhere. It is costing him $650 a month, with years to go. His wife drives a late-model Toyota sedan at $300 a month. Their home is mortgaged to the tune of $135,000. Their bank records, obtained by warrant, show balances of almost $9,000 in checking and savings. In summary, Adam and his wife, who works as a part-time clerk in an insurance office, are living far above their meager means. He stops for gas at a country store and goes inside to pay. When he returns, two gentlemen in jeans and sneakers are waiting. They quickly give their names, mention the FBI, flash badges, and say they would like to talk. For a tough guy who feels even tougher in his uniform, Adam is weak at the knees. Beads of sweat ripple across his forehead. He follows them a mile to an abandoned school with an empty gravel lot. Under an old oak next to what was once a playground, he leans on the edge of a wooden picnic table and tries to sound relaxed.
"What can I do for you fellers?"
Agent Frost says,
"Just a few questions."
"Go right ahead,"
Adam says with a drippy smile. He wipes his large forehead with the back of a sleeve. Agent Thagard says,
"We know you're a guard at Garvin. Been there for what, 7 years?"
"Yes, sir, something like that."
"You know an inmate by the name of Quincy Miller?"
Adam frowns and looks at the tree limbs as if searching deeply. A shake of the head and a quite unconvincing no.
"Don't believe so. A lot of inmates at Garvin."
Frost asks, "How about Robert Earl Lane and John Drummick? Ever meet those guys?" A quick, cooperative smile, and,
"Sure, they're both in Unit E. That's where I'm stationed for now."
Thagard says, "Quincy Miller, who's black, was beaten unconscious 3 days ago in the alley between the gym and the shop next to Unit E. He was stabbed at least 3 times and left for dead. You were on duty when the attack occurred. Know anything about it?"
"I may have heard about it."
"How could you not hear about it?" Frost snaps sharply and takes a step closer.
"A lot of fights at Garvin," Adams says defensively.
Thagard asks,
"You didn't see Lane and Drummick attack Quincy Miller?"
"No."
"We have an informant who says you did. Says you were right there. But the reason you didn't see anything was because you didn't want to. Says you were the lookout. Says you're well known as one of the deacon's favorite gophers."
Adam exhales mightily, as if sucker punched in the gut. He wipes his forehead again and tries in vain to smile, as if amused.
"No way, man, no way!"
Thagard says, "Let's cut the bullshit, Adam. We have search warrants, and we have collected all of your financial crap. We know you have $9,000 in the bank, which is quite impressive for a guy making 12 bucks an hour and whose wife makes 10 for part-time work. A guy with 2 kids, a guy who's never inherited shit from a relative, a guy who spends at least $2,000 a month just on nice wheels and a nice house, not to mention groceries and the phone bills. You're living way above your means, Adam, and we know from our informant that you pick up extra dough running drugs for the deacons. We can prove that in a court tomorrow."
They could not, but Adam certainly didn't know the difference. Frost takes the handoff smoothly with, "You're going to be indicted, Adam. Federal court. The U.S. attorney in Orlando is working on it now. Grand jury comes in tomorrow. But we're not going after the guards. Most of them peddle goods back and forth, pick up some extra cash. The warden doesn't really care, because he wants his inmates stoned. They behave better when they have trouble walking. You know the drill, Adam. We couldn't care less about the contraband. We're on to something much more important. The attack on Quincy Miller was a contract for hire, a hit ordered by someone on the outside. That makes it a conspiracy, and that makes it federal." Adam's eyes water, and he wipes them with a forearm.
"I ain't done nothing. You can't indict me."
Frost says,
"Gee, we've never heard that before."
Thagard says, "The U.S. attorney will grind you to a pulp, Adam. You don't stand a chance. He'll make sure the prison fires you immediately. There goes your salary. There go your bribes, all that cash. Then you'll lose this cute little monster truck with the fat tires and ghetto rims and your house. And shit, Adam, it's gonna be awful."
"You're full of shit,"
he says, trying to get tough, but his voice cracks. They almost feel sorry for him.
"You can't do this."
Frost says, "Oh, we do it all the time, Adam. If you're indicted, it'll take 2 years to get you to trial. More, if the U.S. attorney so chooses. He doesn't care if you're guilty or innocent. He just wants to ruin you if you don't cooperate." Adam's head jerks back as his eyes grow big.
"Cooperate?"
Frost and Thagard exchange grave looks as if they're not sure they should proceed. Thagard leans in and says,
"You're a small fish, Adam. Always have been. Always will be. The U.S. attorney couldn't care less about you and your dipshit little bribery scheme. He wants the deacons, and he wants to know who paid for the hit on Quincy Miller. You play ball with us, we play ball with you."
"You want me to snitch?"
"No. We want you to inform. Big difference. Gather information from your buddies. Pass it along to us. You find out who ordered the hit, and we'll forget about an indictment."
"They'll kill me,"
he says, and finally burst into tears. He sobs loudly into his hands as Frost and Thagard look around. Cars pass on the county road, but no one bothers to look. After a few minutes, he pulls himself together. Thagard says,
"They will not kill you, Adam, because they will not know what you're doing. We handle informants all the time. We know the game."
Frost says, "And if things get too dangerous, Adam, we'll get you out and get you a job in a federal joint. Twice the pay, twice the benefits." Adam looks at them with red eyes and asks,
"Can we keep this quiet? I mean, no one can know about this. Not even my wife."
With the word "we," a deal is struck. Frost says,
"Of course, Adam. You think we tell folks about our confidential informants? Come on, man. We wrote the book on handling informants."
For a long time, nothing is said as Adam stares at the gravel and occasionally wipes fluids from his face. They watch him and are almost sympathetic. He says,
"Can I think about this? Give me some time."
"No," Frost says, "we don't have time. Things are moving fast, Adam. If Quincy dies, then you'll be on the hook for capital murder, federal style."
"What's the charge now?"
"Attempted murder, conspiracy, 30 years max, and the U.S. attorney will go for every last day of it."
He shakes his head and appears ready for more tears. His voice breaks as he says,
"And if I play ball, as you like to say?"
"No indictment. You walk, Adam. Don't be a fool."
Frost closes the deal with, "This is one of those life-altering moments, Adam. You make the right decision right now, and your life goes on. The bad one, and you're going to be locked up with the same savages you've been guarding." Adam stands and bends at the waist, belches. "Excuse me," he says, and walks to the edge of the old playground where he begins retching. Frost and Thagard turn and look toward the road. Adam kneels behind a large bush and vomits loudly for a spell. When he's finished, he shuffles back and sits at the picnic table. His shirt is soaked with sweat, and his cheap brown tie is specked with his lunch.
"Okay," he says hoarsely. "What's the first order of business?"
Frost doesn't hesitate.
"Do either Lane or Drummock have a cell phone?"
"I know Drummock does. I took it to him."
"Where did you get it?"
Adam hesitates before plunging in. When he says what he's about to say, there is no turning back.
"There's a man named Mayhall. Don't know his first name. Don't know if Mayhall is real or fake. Don't know where he lives or where he comes from. I see him once or twice a month. He comes here with the goodies for his boys inside Garvin. Cell phones and dope, usually pills and meth, cheap drugs. I take the stuff in and deliver to the right people. He pays me $1,000 a month in cash, plus a little stash of dope to sell on my own. I'm not the only guard who does this. When you earn 12 an hour, it's hard to survive."
Thagard says,
"We get that. How many Aryan deacons in Garvin?"
25 or 30. The Brotherhood has more."
"How many guards service the deacons?"
"I'm the only one I know of. Certain guards take care of certain groups. I doubt if Mayhall would want anyone else involved. He gets what he wants with me."
"Has he served time?"
"I'm sure he has. You can't join the deacons unless you're in prison."
Frost asks, "Can you get Drummock's cell phone?" Adam shrugs and smiles, as if he's quite clever.
"Sure. Cell phones are prized possessions, and sometimes they get stolen. I'll go to Drummock's cell when he's out on the yard and make it look like a theft."
"How soon?" Thagard asks.
"Tomorrow."
"Okay, do it. We'll track his calls and we'll give you a replacement."
Frost asks, "Will this Mayhall character get suspicious if Drummock finds another phone?" Adam thinks for a moment. Things are still not quite clear. He shakes his head and says,
"I doubt it. These guys buy, sell, trade, steal, barter, you name it."
Thagard leans down and sticks out a hand.
"Okay, Adam. We got a deal, right?"
Adam reluctantly shakes his hand. Frost says, "And your phones are tapped too, Adam. We're monitoring everything, so no stupid moves, okay?" They left him at the picnic table, staring into the distance and wondering how his life could change so fast. Chapter 34. With the FBI throwing its weight around, Quincy is moved to a corner room that is more secure. Two surveillance cameras are mounted prominently above his door. The hospital staff is on high alert, and its guards are more of a presence. The prison sends one over each day for a few hours of hallway monitoring, and Orlando police officers enjoy stopping by to flirt with the nurses. Quincy's condition improves each day, and we slowly begin to believe that he will not die. I'm on a first-name basis with his doctors and staff by now, and everyone is pulling for my client. He is as secure as possible, so I decide to hit the road. The place is driving me crazy. Who doesn't hate sitting around a hospital? Savannah is 5 hours away, and I've never been so homesick. Somewhere around St. Augustine, Susan Ashley calls with the news that old Judge Jerry Plank has entered an order denying our petition for post-conviction relief. His decision is expected. The surprise is that he woke up long enough to do something. We were anticipating a wait of at least a year, but he disposed of it in 2 months. This is actually good news because it speeds along our appeal to the state Supreme Court.
I don't want to pull over and read his opinion. Susan Ashley says it's very brief. A two-page order in which Plank says we provided no new evidence in spite of the recantations from Zeke Huffey and Carrie Holland. Whatever. We were expecting to lose at the circuit court level. I cuss for a few minutes in traffic, then settle down. There are times, many times, when I despise judges, especially blind ones and old ones and white ones, almost all of whom cut their teeth in prosecutors' offices and have no sympathy for anyone accused of a crime. To them, everybody who is charged is guilty and needs time in jail. The system works beautifully and justice always prevails. When my rant is over, I call Maisie as she's reading the order. We discuss the appeal, and she will drop everything and get it ready. When I arrive at the office late in the afternoon, she has the first draft prepared. We discuss it over coffee with Vicky, and I tell stories about the events in Orlando. Adam Stone made a clean swap with John Drummick's phone. He took the old one as he ransacked the cell and the following day handed a new one to Drummick. The FBI is scrambling to track old calls and listening to the new ones. They are confident that their targets will walk into the trap. They have no information on Mayhall, or at least none they can share with me. But they plan to watch him closely the next time he meets with Adam. For 3 straight days before the attack on Quincy, Drummick called a cell phone in Delray Beach north of Boca Raton. The day after the attack, he made only one call to the same number. However, the trail ended when the number fizzled. It was a burner, a disposable phone with a 30-day plan that was paid for by cash at a Best Buy store. Its owner is being very careful. Adam does not have Mayhall's phone number, has never had it. There is nothing to track until Mayhall calls, and he finally does. The FBI grabs the incoming number from Adam's phone and follows it to another cell phone, also in Delray Beach. The puzzle is coming together. Monitoring the phone signal, the FBI picks up Mayhall's scent as he buzzes along Interstate 95 headed north. The car he's driving is registered to one Skip DeLuca, of Delray Beach. White male, age 51, four-time felon with manslaughter his worst sin, paroled 3 years earlier from a Florida prison, currently managing a shop selling used motorcycles. DeLuca, a.k.a. Mayhall, arranges to meet Adam after work at a bar in Orange City, 45 minutes from the prison. Adam says they always meet at the same place and have a quick beer as they talk shop. To avoid suspicion, Adam changes into street clothes. His handlers tape a small wire to his chest. He arrives first, selects a table, does a mic check, all bugs are working. An FBI crew is listening in the back of a van parked in the street behind the bar. After a few curt pleasantries, the real conversation begins. DeLuca.
They didn't kill Miller. What happened?
Adam.
Well, several things went wrong. First, Miller knows how to fight and went crazy. Robert Earl Lane has a busted nose. Took a few minutes to subdue him. Too much time. Once they had him down, they couldn't finish him off before another guard saw him. They didn't cut him enough.
DeLuca.
Where were you?
Adam.
I was there, man. Right where I was supposed to be. I know my turf. The ambush worked perfectly, just couldn't get the guy down.
DeLuca.
Well, he ain't dead, and that's a problem. We got paid for a job that's not finished. The gentlemen I'm dealing with are not happy.
Adam.
Not my fault. I did what I was supposed to do. Can't you get him at the hospital?
DeLuca.
Maybe. We've had a look. Lots of uniforms in the way. His condition improves each day, so our end of the deal stinks more and more. We were supposed to take him out, plain and simple. You tell Drummick and Lane that I'm really pissed about their lousy job. They promised me they could do it.
Adam.
How much heat are you taking?
DeLuca.
I'll deal with it.
Their conversation is brief, and when they finish their beers, they step outside. DeLuca hands Adam a brown paper grocery bag with $1,000 in cash, two new cell phones, and a supply of drugs. He leaves without saying goodbye and hurries away. Adam waits until he's out of sight, then tells his handlers DeLuca is gone. He drives around the block and meets them on a side street. Technically, legally, the FBI has the goods for an indictment against DeLuca, Adam, Drummick, and Lane for a contract killing or an attempted one. But the two inmates are already locked up. Adam is too valuable as an informant, and DeLuca can lead them to the real catch. 20 minutes down the road, DeLuca sees blue lights in his mirror. He checks his speedometer and knows damn well he is not violating the law. He is on parole and treasures his freedom. Thus, he sticks to the rules, or at least the rules of the road. A county officer takes his license and registration and spends half an hour calling it in. DeLuca begins to squirm. When the officer returns, he asks rudely, "You been drinking?"
"One beer," DeLuca answers truthfully.
"That's what they all say."
Another county car with flashing lights arrives and parks in front of DeLuca's car. Two officers get out and glare at him as if he has just murdered some children. The three huddle and kill more time as DeLuca fumes. Finally, he is ordered out of the car.
"What the hell for?"
he demands as he closes his door. He should not have. Two officers grab him and force him across the hood of his car while another slaps on handcuffs.
"You were swerving recklessly,"
the first officer says.
"The hell I was," DeLuca snaps. "Just shut up."
They search his pockets, take his phone and wallet, and toss him rather roughly into the back seat of the first patrol car. As he is taken away, an officer calls a wrecker, then calls the FBI. At the station, DeLuca is placed in a holding room where he is forced to pose for a mugshot, then left to sit for the next 4 hours. A federal magistrate on standby in Orlando quickly approves two search warrants, one for DeLuca's apartment, the other for his car. FBI agents enter the apartment in Delray Beach and go to work. It is a one-bedroom apartment with sparse, cheap furnishings and no evidence whatsoever of a woman. The kitchen counters are covered with dirty dishes. Laundry is piled in the hallway. The refrigerator has nothing more than beer, water, and cold cuts. The coffee table in the den is littered with hardcore porn magazines. A laptop is found in a tiny office and carried outside to a van where a technician copies the hard drive. Two burners are found, opened, analyzed, tapped, and put back on the desk. Listening devices are hidden throughout the apartment. After 2 hours, the team is finished, and while normally it would be fastidious in rearranging things, DeLuca is such a slob, it would be impossible for him or anyone else to notice that a surveillance team had spent the evening rummaging through his apartment. Another team goes through his car and finds nothing important but another burner. Evidently, DeLuca has no permanent cell phone number. Digging through the cheap phone, the technician hits pay dirt in the contacts file. DeLuca has only 10 numbers in memory, and one is for Mickey Mercado, the operative who showed up in court to eavesdrop on our motion for post-conviction relief. In the recents file, there are 22 incoming and outgoing calls from and to Mercado in the past 2 weeks. A GPS monitor is attached to the inside of his rear bumper so the car cannot escape surveillance. At 10 p.m., the county sheriff enters the holding room and apologizes to DeLuca. He explains that there was a bank robbery near Naples earlier in the day, and the getaway car matched DeLuca's. They suspected him,
but now realize they were wrong. He is free to go. DeLuca is not gracious and forgiving, and leaves as quickly as possible. He is suspicious and decides not to return to Delray Beach. He is also wary of using his burner, so he makes no calls. He drives 2 hours to Sarasota and checks into a budget motel. The next morning, the same federal magistrate issues a warrant authorizing the search of the apartment of Mercado and the electronic surveillance of his telephones. Another warrant directs his cell phone provider to open its records. However, before the bugging is complete, DeLuca calls Mercado from a payphone. He is then tracked from Sarasota to Coral Gables, where his trail is picked up by a team of FBI agents. He finally parks at an Afghan kebab restaurant on Dolphin Avenue and goes inside. 15 minutes later, a young female agent saunters inside for a bite and identifies DeLuca eating with Mickey Mercado. DeLuca's chilling comment to Adam that they had a look at Quincy in the hospital ratchets up the security there. Quincy is moved again to another corner room, and he is never left unwatched. Agent Agnes Knowlton keeps me abreast of these developments, though I do not know everything. I caution her against using our phones, and we use encrypted emails. She is confident that, one, Quincy will be protected, and two, they will soon ensnare Mercado in their conspiracy. One source of concern is that he has dual citizenship and can come and go as he pleases. If he becomes suspicious, he might simply run home and never be seen again. Knowlton believes that Nele Mercado will be our ultimate prize. The conspirators above him, the real criminals, are probably not in the U.S. and virtually immune from prosecution. With the FBI fully on board, and with our client still alive, we can return our attention to exonerating him. Chapter 35. The Sangria is Calling. Glenn Colacurchy is thirsty and wants to meet again at the Bull in Gainesville. After 2 days of trying to rest in Savannah, I head south again, and the adventure continues. Quincy has been eased out of his coma and is fairly alert. His vitals improve each day, and his doctors are talking about moving him out of ICU and into a private room where they can begin planning the surgeries to mend his bones. They repeatedly assure me that security is tight, so I'm not compelled to hustle down for more hours of sitting in the hall and staring at my feet. I get to the Bull minutes after 4 p.m., and Glenn's tall glass is already half empty. His large, fleshy nose is turning pink, a shade that almost matches the drink. I order the same and look around for his cute little secretary, who I catch myself thinking about more than I should. I don't see B. Glenn has read about Quincy's problems and wants the inside scoop. Since I've known 100 small-town windbag lawyers like him, I reveal nothing new. As with most prison beatings, details are sparse and sketchy. In a grave conspiratorial whisper, he informs me that the local weekly newspaper in Ruiz County is now following Quincy's case and our efforts to exonerate him. I absorb this in rapt attention and pass on the opportunity to tell him that Vicky is monitoring half the newspapers weekly and daily in the state of Florida. She keeps a running record of every word printed about the case. We live on the internet. Glenn stumbles across it once a week. This meeting has a purpose other than drinking, and after half an hour, I realized that the sangria is the oil of conversation. He smacks his lips, brushes his mouth with a sleeve, and finally gets down to business.
So, I gotta tell you, Post, I've been thinking about this case night and day. Really into it, you know. This all happened on my watch,
Back in my glory days when I was in the state senate and also ran the biggest law firm in the county. And well, you know, I thought I was really in the loop. I figured Fitzner was working both sides of the street, but we stayed in our lanes, if you know what I mean. He ran his show, got his votes. I did the same. When Keith got his head blown off and your boy got convicted for it, well, I was satisfied. I wanted the death penalty. The whole town was relieved. Looking back, though,
he sees the waiter, flags him over, drains the dregs from his glass, and orders another round. I have at least 6 inches of liquid left in mine. With plenty of time on the clock, this could spiral into one sloppy afternoon. He catches his breath and continues,
"Looking back, though, things don't add up. I'm kin to half the county and represented the other half. Last time I ran for re-election, I got 80% of the vote, and I was pissed about the lost 20. There's an old deputy, won't give you the name, but he used to run cases for me. I'd pay him in cash and give him a cut when we settled. Did the same for ambulance drivers and tow truck operators. Had them all on the payroll. Anyway, the deputy is still around, lives near the Gulf, and I've been talking to him. He retired years ago. Health's in the tank, but hell, he's pushing 80. He worked on Fitzner's staff and managed to stay on his good side. He did the light stuff, traffic, football games, school events. Wasn't much of a cop, but didn't want to be. Just enjoyed the uniform and the paycheck. Says you're right. Says Fitzner was on the take with the drug traffickers. Says it was known throughout the force. Fitzner had these two brothers.
Chip and Dip. He pauses and flashes a smile with his yellow teeth.
You're pretty good, Post.
We are thorough.
Anyway, Chip and Dip ran things for Fitzner and held everybody in line. The inner circle kept the money and thought they were keeping the secrets, too, but of course, it's a small town.
The waiter returns with 2 jugs of hooch and looks at my first, virtually untouched, as if to say, "Let's go, pal. This is a real bar." I give him a smirk and take a long pull on the straw. Glenn does the same, and after a noisy swallow says,
"The deputy tells me Kenny Taft was not killed by some random gang of drug thugs. Not at all. He says some of the deputies back then strongly suspected Fitzner set up the ambush. Says he needed to put the clamps on Taft, who knew something. He says it worked just swell, but with one minor hitch. A man got shot. Evidently, either Kenny Taft or Brace Gilmer managed to get off a lucky round, and one of the gun thugs went down. The story goes that he bled out on the way to the hospital, and they dumped his body behind a queer joint in Tampa. Just another unsolved murder. Luckily for Fitzner, the guy was not a deputy and not from Seabrook, so no red flags were raised. Any of this sound familiar, Post?"
I shake my head no. I will not repeat anything Bruce Gilmer told me in Idaho. Another long pull, and he's energized for more narrative.
"So, the obvious question is, why did Fitzner want to get rid of Kenny Taft?"
"That's the puzzle," I say helpfully.
"Well, the rumor is that Kenny Taft got wind of the plan to burn the shed where the cops stored crime scene stuff, and that Taft removed several boxes of evidence before the fire. No one knew this, of course, and once he had the goods, he was afraid to do anything with them. He must have said too much, and word filtered back to Fitzner, who set up the ambush."
"Several boxes?" I ask as my mouth immediately goes dry and my heart starts pounding. I drink sangria to calm myself.
"That's the rumor, Post. Don't know what was destroyed in the fire, and don't know what was removed by Kenny Taft. Just rumors. There was a missing flashlight, as I recall. I've read your post-conviction petition, saw where you lost last week, and anyway, the flashlight was presumed to have been destroyed. Right, Post?"
"That's right."
"Maybe it wasn't destroyed."
"That's interesting," I managed to say with calmness. Does the rumor cover the part that reveals what Kenny did with the boxes of evidence?
No, it doesn't. But interestingly enough, the rumor says that during his funeral service, which was fit for a 5-star general, Fitzner had 2 of his men go through Kenny's house, inch by inch, looking for the boxes. They have never been found, according to the rumor.
But you have a hunch, right?
No, but I'm working on it, Post. I have lots of sources, old and new, and I'm on the prowl. Just thought you'd like to know.
And you're not worried, I asked.
Worried about what?
Worried that you might discover something that has been well hidden. Quincy Miller didn't kill Keith Russo. The murder was ordered by a drug gang with Fitzner's blessing and cover-up. The gang is still around, and 10 days ago, they tried to kill Quincy in prison. They don't like our way of digging up the past, and they won't like yours either. He laughs and says,
I'm too old to worry, Post. Plus, I'm having too much fun.
Then why are we hiding in a bar in Gainesville?
Because there aren't any decent bars in Seabrook, which is probably a good thing for a guy like me. Besides, this is my college town. Love the place. Are you worried, Post?
Let's just say that I'm being careful. Chapter 36. The file on Mickey Mercado gets thicker. With warrants, his income tax returns are obtained and scoured. He lists his occupation as a security consultant, a sole proprietor as opposed to a partnership or corporation. His business address is in the same building as Varick and Valencia, Nash Cooley's law firm. Last year's reported gross income was slightly more than $200,000, with deductions for a mortgage and a couple of nice cars. He's single, divorced, with no dependents. No charitable activities at all. The FBI has no interest in wasting its time pursuing prison guards who peddle dope or prison gangs at war with each other. But Special Agent Agnes Knowlton can't resist the scenario of a crime boss hiring the Aryan Deacons to kill an innocent man whose lawyers are trying to exonerate him. She makes the decision to roll the dice in a big way and put Skip DeLuca in a vice. It is a high-risk, high-reward strategy. With the cooperation of the U.S. attorney, she appears before a federal grand jury and presents the evidence. John Drummock, Robert Earl Lane, Adam Stone, and Skip DeLuca are indicted for the attempted contract killing and aggravated assault of Quincy Miller. The indictments are sealed, and the FBI waits in ambush. I'm waiting too, hanging around Quincy's new hospital room and helping to nurse him back to good health. Our conversations are brief because talking quickly tires him. He remembers nothing about the attack. As for his short-term memory, there's not much there. Adam Stone checks in. Mr. Mayhall is on the way with more contraband and cash. Because of his near arrest last time, Mayhall decides to change meeting places. He picks a taco joint at the northern edge of Sanford, population 50,000. Adam arrives first in street clothes, gets a table with a view of the parking lot, and helps himself to some tacos. He has been told by the FBI that Mayhall, real name DeLuca, is now driving a new silver Lexus that he has just leased. Adam munches away and watches for the Lexus. It arrives 15 minutes late and parks next to Adam's monster truck. DeLuca gets out and walks hurriedly to the restaurant's side door, but he never makes it. 2 agents in dark suits materialize from nowhere and block his path. They flash badges and point to a black SUV waiting by a dumpster. DeLuca knows it would be foolish to resist or to say anything. He drops his head and slumps his shoulders as they lead him away. Once again,
he's managed to screw up his life in the free world. Once again, he feels the tight clamp of metal handcuffs. Adam is the only person inside the restaurant to witness the drama. He is not pleased by the events. His world just got rocked again. He's been promised by the FBI that his indictment will be tossed in return for his cooperation. He's been promised a better job. But who carries out these promises? The plan, as far as he knows, is to grab DeLuca before he can squeal to anyone. Thus, the deacons should not learn of his arrest, nor should they have any way of knowing that Adam, their favorite gopher and mule, is now an informant. But Adam knows that in prison, loyalties change by the day, and secrets are hard to keep. He fears for his life and wants another job. He finishes a taco and watches the SUV drive away. Immediately, a tow truck arrives and takes the new Lexus. When things are back to normal, Adam finishes his last taco and walks to his truck, suspecting that he too will soon be arrested, or worse, shanked and left to bleed out. For almost an hour, Skip DeLuca rides in the rear seat with cuffs firmly around his wrists and says not a word. The agent seated next to him doesn't speak either. Nor do the two up front. The side windows are heavily tinted so that those inside barely see out, and those outside certainly cannot see the passengers. The SUV whines and putters through traffic and finally makes its way to the rear of the FBI building in Maitland. DeLuca is walked up two flights of stairs and marched to a windowless room where more agents are waiting. He's shoved into a chair and his cuffs are removed. No fewer than six agents are in the room, an impressive show of force. Skip wonders if all this muscle is really necessary. If he made a break for it, where would he go? Relax, everybody. A woman walks in, and the men stiffen. She sits across from Skip, but the men stay on their feet at the ready. She says, "Mr. DeLuca, my name is Agnes Knowlton, Special Agent, FBI, and you're under arrest for the attempted contract killing of Quincy Miller and for aggravated assault and a few other less significant crimes. We just searched your car and found 300 capsules of crystal meth, so we'll add those charges later. Here's your indictment. Have a look." She slides across the indictment, and DeLuca takes his time reading it. He's not impressed and reads with a smug look, as if checking box scores. When he's finished, he gently places it on the table and offers her a drippy smile. She hands him another sheet of paper with his Miranda rights. He reads them and signs at the bottom. He's done this dance before. She says, "We'll turn you over to the jailers in a moment, but first I'd like to have a little chat. Do you want a lawyer?"
"No. I want two lawyers. Maybe three."
"You need them. We can stop now and provide you with counsel tomorrow. But if that happens, then we cannot have my little chat, and that will be very bad for you."
"I'm listening," he says calmly.
"You have an extensive criminal record, and you're now facing another 30 years on all counts. You're 51, so you'll die behind bars."
"Thank you."
"Don't mention it. Frankly, you're not much of a target, and we have better things to do than fret over the games played by prison gangs. But a contract killing is another matter. Somebody paid for it. You tell us who, how much, all the details, and we can guarantee a light sentence for you and years of freedom thereafter. That is, if you stay out of trouble, which seems doubtful."
"Thanks."
"Don't mention it. We're offering a sweet deal, Mr. DeLuca, and the offer expires in exactly 43 minutes. She glances at her watch as she says this. "You can't leave this room, and you certainly cannot call anyone."
"I'll pass. I'm not a snitch, not a rat."
"Of course not. Didn't mean to imply. But let's not kid ourselves. You're not exactly the president of the Rotary Club either.
Look in the mirror, Skip. Face the truth. You're nothing but a con, a crook, a criminal with a rap sheet, a member of a violent gang, a racist, a longtime loser with a history of doing stupid things. Now you've been caught bribing a guard and hauling dope for your fellow deacons. Pretty stupid, Skip. Why in hell can't you do something smart in your life? Do you really want to spend the next 30 years locked up with those animals? And it's federal, Skip, and not a camp. We'll make sure you get a U.S. pen.
Come on.
A U.S. pen, Skip. The worst of the worst. For the next 30 years, Garvin was a picnic compared to where you're headed.
Skip takes a deep breath and studies the ceiling. He's not afraid of prison, not even a U.S. pen. He spent most of his life behind the fence, and he's survived, at times even prospered. His brothers are there, all sworn together in a vicious but protective gang. No work, no bills to pay, 3 meals a day, plenty of drugs, especially for a gang member, lots of sex, if one is so inclined. However, he's just met a lady he's quite fond of, his first romance in many years. She's a bit older, not rich, but with some means, and they've talked of living together and taking a trip. Skip can't go far because he's on parole. A passport is only a dream. But she's given him a glimpse of another life, and he really doesn't want to go back to prison. Because he's such an experienced con, he knows how to play the game. This tough gal can find some room to negotiate. He asks,
"So, how much time are we talking about?"
"As I said, 30 years.
"With a deal?"
3 to 5.
"I can't survive 3 to 5. The answer is no."
"If you can't survive 3 to 5, how can you expect to survive 30?
"I've been there, okay? I know the turf."
"Indeed you do." Knowlton stands and glares at him. "I'll be back in 30 minutes, Skip. Right now, you're wasting my time."
He asks,
"Can I have some coffee?"
Knowlton spreads her arms and says,
"Coffee? I don't have any coffee. Anybody here got coffee?"
The other 6 agents look around as if searching for coffee. Finding none, they shake their heads. She marches out of the room and someone closes the door. 3 agents remain. The largest one parks himself by the door in a heavy chair and begins deleting voicemails. The other 2 sit at the table with Skip and immediately find urgent work with their cell phones. The room is silent, and Skip pretends to nod off. 15 minutes later, the door opens and Knowlton walks in. She doesn't sit, but looks down at Skip and says,
"We just picked up Mickey Mercado in Coral Gables, and we're getting ready to offer him the deal of a lifetime. If he takes it first, you're screwed, and our offer is off the table. Think fast, Skip, if that's possible."
She turns around and marches out again. Skip manages to keep a poker face as his bowels grind and he feels nauseous. His vision blurs as his head spins. They not only know about Mercado, but now they have him. This is overwhelming. Skip glances around and notices the 2 agents at the table watching his every move. He is breathing heavier, and he cannot stop it. His forehead turns wet. They make notes on their phones and send messages. A moment passes, and he does not retch. He keeps swallowing hard, and another moment passes. 10 minutes later, she's back. She sits this time, a clear indication that she plans to really squeeze his balls. She begins pleasantly with,
"You're a fool, Skip. Any con in your shoes who can't take this deal is a fool."
"Thank you. Let's talk about witness protection."
She doesn't smile, but she is obviously pleased as they take a giant step in the right direction. She says,
"We can talk about it, but I'm not sure it will work in this case."
"You can make it work. You do it all the time.